Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Adrian Brine, Partnerships Manager at Citation, and today we're talking about how veterinary practices can build a culture of well-being that really sticks. Long hours, emotional intensity, client pressures, they're part of the job, but they don't have to come at the cost of your team's health. So, in this episode, we're digging into practical ways to create a more supportive, resilient workplace. Things you can actually take away and try in your own practice. I'm very lucky to be joined by a fantastic panel. I've got Emma McGrath from our employment law team here at Citation. I have Chris White from the Veterinary Management Group, bringing the management and leadership perspective. And I've Stephen Goodyear from SPIVS and a practice owner himself as well, offering insight into the operational realities facing practice teams today. So to kick us off, we're going to start with the basics. What do we actually mean by well-being in a veterinary context? And how is it different from things like burnout or compassion fatigue? So Stephen, let me start with you. When we talk about well-being at work in a veterinary setting, what does that actually look like in practice?
I think well-being, again, it's sometimes something that we kind of almost know it when you're feeling you've got it. I think as a broad thought, though, it's a lot to do with whether you can sustain, from a job point of view, whether you can sustain your job as long as you want to. So I like to think about it as, are all the things that you're combining together in that, meaning that the job you're doing, you can do forever or for as long as you want to. And that combines a mixture of, you know, are you getting clinically fulfilled? Are you autonomous in your job? Do you feel like you're making a difference? Your own physical health, dietary health, sleep. Are you getting connection, the connection you want to with your team at work and your family at home? And perhaps part of the big part of it tends to be the purpose, the reason you go to work, your why, is it the same as the vision of the practice? I think that's an area where we can get into sort of conflict if the practice has different values to individuals within it. And obviously, one of the complexities of that is that everybody's well-being is slightly varied. Some people want to be more autonomous, some less. Some people want to have a really strong connection with people at work, and others are happier just to go to work. So, and I think that's why it can be slightly different for everybody. But I think it's still that sense of, am I enjoying, and can I do this job long term, forever, basically? Or is there something that's out of balance that means I can only do this for a finite period of time before something changes or burns out?
Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. And Emma, from an employment law and HR perspective, how would you describe good well-being in a practice team?
Yeah, so I suppose, well-being, you know, it's all about the employee's happiness, health, as Stephen's been saying, feelings of security in the job. It's obviously physical and mental issues. And if you have got good well-being at work, then, you know, employees will be productive, engaged, you know, collaborative. So it's all, you know, really excellent for the practice. One thing I would say is that, you know, good well-being doesn't mean not having stress. You know, obviously, veterinary practice work is very stressful. And it doesn't have to be about not having stress within your day, but rather that you can cope with that stress, you know, that you have the coping mechanism in place to mean it's not getting on top of you. You know, that's all going to contribute towards that good well-being at work. And obviously, you know, well-being does fall under an employer's duty of care. So it's all about sort of, you know, thinking how the managers are aware of it and are looking out for their employees in terms of their well-being.
Great. And Chris, that same question about defining well-being to you, please, from a leadership and a management standpoint. I mean, is it about people, how they feel day to day? Is it performance? Is it a mix of both or something completely different?
Well, it's both. It's about people performing well without harming themselves in the process of doing that. Strongly linked to employee engagement, I would say, and the idea of, instead of work-life balance, I prefer the idea of energy giving versus energy sapping. So it's linked to the idea of doing more things that are energy giving than energy sapping, and making sure that you get recovery time as well, even if you absolutely love your work. And you work really hard and do 60 hours a week or whatever it is that you're doing, you do need to have recovery time, even if that's something you love. And because I think it's very linked to employee engagement, I think it's important to see what is required for employee engagement and well-being. So one, a sense of purpose, which has been touched on as well, a sense of purpose in the role that I do in the organisation that I work for, to Stephen's points about values. having engaging managers, so people that are appreciative of you, they're fair, respectful, treat you as an individual, that have concern for your well-being, that equip you and support you to do the job, that organise the work efficiently and effectively for you, and with a facilitating and empowering approach rather than controlling. And employee voice, so being listened to, feeling involved, that you can speak out and you can challenge. And finally, integrity, so that you know the practice you work for, the organisation you work for, lives the values that it sticks up on the wall, behaves as it says it should do. Now, from a performance point of view, what we should remember is performance is not just what you achieve, it's how you go about doing it. So it's the results that you have and your behaviour. And it's important also to think about what are the causes of performance, whether that be good or bad. So internal causes of performance are the skills, the knowledge, the motivation that you may have. And external causes include things like the work environment that you have, equipment, materials, time, the information, instructions that you have, and teamwork and relationships. So when we look at well-being and performance, where people's performance is dipping, much like when we define what the different aspects of well-being are that need to be taken care of, each cause does require a different approach. So if the cause of poor performance is knowledge or skills lacking, then we need training, coaching, etc. But if there's something that is more psychological in there, that requires a different response. And leaders influence well-being through what they do, through rotas, staffing levels, decision-making, how they communicate, the culture of the practice. And having things like individual resilience is really helpful, but it can't compensate for poor systems and culture. And it's not necessarily the right answer to every aspect of well-being. And it's not about making tough jobs easy, as we've said there. It's a difficult job. It's about just making those jobs sustainable.
Excellent. Thank you. Staying on the subject of well-being, we hear a lot of different terms thrown around: stress, burnout, compassion fatigue, moral distress. And Emma, I'm going to ask you to try to help us to unpack those a little bit. So, Emma, how would you explain the difference between, say, normal work-related stress, longer-term burnout, compassion fatigue from dealing with clients and patients, and moral distress when clinicians feel they can't do what they think is right?
Yeah, so I suppose, as I said before, you know, all jobs have some level of stress. And, you know, in a veterinary practice, you know, it's probably a higher stress job than others. So, you know, there is going to be normal work-related stress without a doubt. But as I said before, about sort of coping mechanisms, and as we've touched on, things like, you know, it is a very worthwhile job, things like that will help you sort of get through more stressful situations. When we're talking about sort of longer term burnout, compassion fatigue, those are all symptoms of poor well-being. You know, that is some form of, you know, poor mental health or some form of effect on the employee. And that's where, you know, you want managers to be alert to issues like that, to perhaps be trained on things to look out for. But equally, they're not supposed to be medical experts. So I wouldn't want managers to panic and think, well, I don't understand the different symptoms between these different conditions. It's more about liaising with your employees, speaking to them, understanding how they feel and what is making them feel, you know, a particular sort of negative feeling towards a certain situation.
I think really interesting what you're saying about stress, and I think it works. I think we need, well, not need to, but I think viewing stress in certain ways as it's often automatic to think stress is bad, we need to de-stress your day. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think some instances that's very true. But when we, prior to the podcast, we were chatting about what to the team, what things were, when were the best days that you ever had a practice in the practice compared to when were the worst days? The best days are never the days that had no stress. They were never the days of three consults, a long morning tea, another consult, a long lunch. Those were the days that everybody says, I banging my head against the wall, I don't want to be here. The best days were the days that were usually full of what we would call stress and intensity, sometimes very much verging on almost the edge of being out of control, chaos, with multiple patients coming in, deaths. But usually the reason why it became the best day was because it was interesting. They felt fulfilled. The team in a really knife edge chaotic situation, gelled together, everyone grew to their strengths. And so I think we sometimes automatically think if you're burned out or tired or stressed, all of the things, the solution is you just need sort of less stress, instead of realizing sometimes the stress is probably in our job inherently a fundamental, it's not a bug, it's a feature of the job.
Yeah,
that we can't take, you know, some days are going to be three patients walking at the same time and we can't avoid it. So to acknowledge that and figure out how we're going to understand it, and realizing that that also not only can be stressful, but also can give us the absolute amazing days that we have. And so I think that's a really thing for us as leaders to do, is not automatically default to, we have to cut down your stress, you shouldn't have a stressful job.
Yeah.
Humans and vets and nurses can do amazing things under stress. You know, the times we've had these intense situations are doing, frankly, amazing things. It means we can do this under stress. We have to learn how to deal with it. And I think one of the things to do that is to have those, too much stress too long too often is what then leads to burnout.
And yeah,
those decompressive spaces where we go, stop, and allow yourself to process the stress and deal with that can help one developing into a catastrophic, career-threatening burnout.
Yeah, and I think some of the things you've touched on there are things that are sort of coping mechanisms. So, you know, a sense of achievement that you've had a really, you know, you can see you've done good. And obviously, you know, that is brilliant. But also you mentioned about teamwork, for example. So again, having like a really well-functioning, close-knit team that are working together, that is a brilliant, isn't it? And it's and the achieving that practice's goal.
Yeah, and we had exact similar situation with a patient crash a couple of weeks ago. And when we were really informally reviewing it with a cup of tea, sit on the floor, having a bit of a teary cry, talking to my head nurse, one of the things that gave her a real buzz from that was how seven or eight members of her team, from junior to most experienced, all slotted in and did a job. So some of the training that we had put in place, and she had specifically put in place, that was feedback for her to say, wow, I trained this person. They now did exactly what we said in a really high stress situation, and it all worked. So that sort of feedback for everyone to say, you are doing a good job, let's work better on it, is incredible.
Yeah,
there's a big difference between that all day and that being every day. Yeah,
completely.
Fabulous. And Chris, is there a risk if leaders treat everything as just stress and don't separate it out into, you know, separately stress, burnout, compassion, fatigue, and moral distress?
Of course, because, well, everybody works in the veterinary world. In this room, we understand the importance of diagnosis in order to be able to produce the right treatment. So there's a real risk of harm if we misidentify what's doing the difference between burnout versus a normal workday stress, as we touched on the previous question there. If we don't diagnose it correctly, there's a real risk of harm to individuals, to patient care and safety, client care, the trust and culture of the team, as well as legal and organizational risks, as we're neglecting our employer duty to assess, manage, and make reasonable adjustments.
Fabulous. Thank you. And Stephen, thinking again about your own business, any more examples, please, of how these things show up in real life?
I think those decompressive gaps are really important. They don't show up on a balance sheet, and they don't show up in pretty much any KPIs that we measure. But the ability to just slot in a big breath, decompressive, inefficient from a business financial point of view, where particularly following those stressful environments, or you know, we talking again to one of our leadership team the other day, one of the questions was just, what do you need now? And the answer was, I just need some time to do some things that we had all been piling on jobs on top. And it was very obvious to both of us what was needed was just time. It was literally half a day a morning, not being badgered by everybody in the business. And a big part of that was having the conversation, and also as a leader, me giving the permission to say, yes, I give you permission to take that time, because certainly in any business, I think everyone is juggling a lot of balls and not wanting to let anybody down. And she didn't want to let me down by not doing the other jobs. And part of our role is to look out for some of those things. And as we talked before about understanding the team, whether that's through contribution compass profiling or anything, to be able to say, you are going to talk to me in a certain way or not, or avoid talking to me in a certain way. So sometimes I need to look out for and look for when you're going to have a problem, and almost expect that you're going to have a problem, or assume you're having a problem, and say, what problem are you having, rather than how are you okay today? And certainly in that instance, that was the conversation was, I assume that you are going to be struggling because I've seen 50 things fall into your lap. Which of those things do you need help with and what can I as your boss do? And in that instance, it was literally just permission to say, I give you permission to come in at 1 o'clock tomorrow and do those other things at home without someone banging on your door. And that's a big sigh of relief of, great, we both know what we're doing and, you know, that's worth its weight in gold for stress and burnout and all of those things. And then that passes down the team because she then sees that I give her permission to do that and that's how the business runs. So she can give her team permission for individual team members that say, I'm having trouble with X, Y, and Z. Can I have something unique to me?
And that's really interesting and hugely important that you are proactive in looking for those stress points or that burnout or that stress again. So, Emma, I guess if I turn to you now and talk about warning signs. So if well-being is starting to decline for an individual, what might colleagues or managers or even clients notice? Are there early red flags that people should look out for?
Yeah, I suppose it's thinking about a change. So it could be like a dip in performance. So, you know, somebody making more mistakes than usual, for example, or a change in attitude. You know, certainly I think sometimes you see somebody being perhaps a lot snappier or more tearful if they're sort of struggling emotionally. You can obviously see it through increased levels of sickness absence, you know, or certainly a sort of an unusual pattern of sickness or things like lateness. You know, if somebody's feeling sort of negative, it might be that they're actually struggling to get up and going in the morning and that's having a difference. Change in appearance can also be of relevance, you know, whether you're taking less time on yourself, you know, but it's all about, as I said, it's all about change. And I suppose we're coming back again to, knowing somebody and knowing what they're normally like. And, you know, some people aren't as chatty as others or, you know, but if you know that that's the case and then you're suddenly finding that somebody who would usually have a conversation, you know, at the kettle isn't anymore, then that is, you know, something to look out for. I think another just other point that I wanted to make was that it might be that you're feeling like the work environment isn't that different. So, you know, you might be less looking out for a change in somebody. But of course, it's really important to remember that as much as we all try to leave our home environment at home, you know, that can come into the workplace. So, you know, obviously it might be that somebody is going through something at home, which is causing them to feel very stressed or, you know, a dip in their well-being, even though actually when you're thinking, well, I don't think that can be the case because, you know, the work is as usual.
Excellent. Well, look, a long list there of some really useful and practical early warning signs to look out for at an individual level. But Chris, if I can turn to you, what about a team level? So what are the signs that not just an individual, but a whole team might be struggling, might become disengaged or heading towards burnout? What might you see in team meetings, day-to-day behaviour, or indeed in your rota patterns and sickness levels?
So, yeah, this is all about pattern spotting, really. There's no one thing that jumps out. Looking for changes in energy and engagement in meetings, day-to-day behavior shifts. So we talked about personality styles earlier on. And one of my favorite ways of looking at it is if you have a particular bent towards one particular insights or disc color profile, that on a good day, this is how you behave. And on a bad day, this is how you behave. So looking out for more of those bad day behaviors. So for example, the greens that we spoke about, on a good day, they're caring and friendly. On a bad day, they may be withdrawn and dismissive. On a good day, a red, maybe let's go get them. On a bad day, they may be bad tempered and aggressive and these sorts of things. So are we seeing more bad day behaviors? Are we coming up with what we define as attitude problems? So rather than just being very dismissive and going, attitude problem, there might be some causes around that rather than dismissing them or labeling them in that way. Of course, rotas that we've mentioned. So is there an increase generally in any kind of last minute changes, any particular shifts that people are trying to avoid or working with any particular teams or people that's in there? Sickness absence patterns. So, you know, are there lots of short, frequent absences or any stress-related ones on certain days or times and so on? But also just, is there less laughter? I think a lot of us like to have fun at work. Is there less laughter going on when you ask people how they are? Is there more of the, I'm fine, oh, it's just that I'm a bit busy? That sort of, those subtle signs that you're looking out for.
Wonderful. Thank you. And then finally, Stephen, last word on the topic of early warning signs. Earlier, you talked about how you are proactive in looking for this in your own business. But, you know, any other particular changes in behaviour, communication or performance that normally make you think, hold on, something's not right here, I need to step in?
I think as we've sort of just discussed, a lot of it is about, and it sounds very cliche, but it's really true, the sort of understanding your team, how they normally behave, how they don't normally behave, things like that change. And that can be as simple as someone just being very quiet in a meeting who doesn't normally behave like that. Understanding the team also, you can, if you have someone who's very protective of their team as a leader, you can be looking out for the issues when their team is getting attacked and knowing how they're going to respond to it. Really subtle things, you know, shifts not getting filled for overtime, as Chris mentioned, people trying to avoid certain circumstances or certain shifts or certain teams, or vet not wanting to work with a nurse or vice versa, or changing shifts that you can very easily miss because everything flows. But sometimes they're the really subtle signs that, as you say, something's not there. And the laughter is a great one. Veterinary practice is really stressful a lot of the time. But we do, just by means of needing to survive, develop a really good sense of humour where we can all have a joke and a chuckle. And when that starts to dip, then to say, why is that? Is everyone overworked, understaffed, all of the conditions, just to ask people. And a really potent question sometimes, I think, is just to say to someone, you know, are you okay? What a meeting, a disciplinary meeting, anything like that, that can start, feels very tense, but you can sometimes radically change it just with a big breath and are you okay? To diffuse the situation where we thought we were going to have a big punching fight, but actually, let's have a conversation about it.
Thank you. So moving then to the final area that I'd like to explore on this particular podcast, which is practical tools and wins. So, Stephen, from your viewpoint, is there anything that sounded small on paper that made a big difference in how your team felt on a day-to-day basis at your business?
I don't know if it was small on paper. It sounded a bit scary, as well as perhaps being small. We've discussed it a few times here, but it was personality profiling. We used the Contribution Compass tech tool, and it felt scary and odd because we'd never done it before. And it was one of those, we often talk about knowing your team, and that feels like, yes, I'd love to know my team, but I just don't know how. Do I just talk to them? Do I ask them specific questions? So for us, that was a huge game-changing thing for us to learn. And you can use their external companies that will do it for you, to teach everyone why their brain works, how their brain works, why it works differently to other people's, why their learning style and structure is different to other people in the team, how they deal with stress. As Chris said, what do they tend to do on a happy, fulfilled day versus what they do on a stress day? And for us, that's been immensely changing. It's you can either just do it, pin it on the wall and then forget about it, or if you engage with it properly, and we use it almost on a daily basis in terms of dealing with our team, it helps us sort of de-escalate conflicting situations, because instead of saying, actually, hey, you're this sort of person and I'm this sort of person, stop being like that, we can say, actually, it's almost taking it as a third person. We can say, actually, we know, because you know and I know, that you are this sort of person. That doesn't exclude them and mean they can't be a vet or a practice manager or anything. It's just to say, look, your behavior often is like this. Mine is often like this. Yours appears to me like this, and mine does to this, and mine is probably equally as annoying. And we just can't understand each other, but we put it on paper and take it as a almost dehumanized, de-escalate it. It feels much easier to talk about, to sort of say, often we'll say, actually, when we're talking about feedback, is to avoid saying, aid, you are this person or you are the problem. But if we can say this behavior that we've moved to one side because it's a green behavior or blue behavior, is once we understand that. And an example of that is one of the areas of the profile are a very high proportion of vets are very data driven, analytical. They're blue in various DISC profiles. And that's by their nature, their job, and they're very good at it. And like everything, there are pros to that. It's amazing in some circumstances. But one of the disadvantages can be that if you start a meeting and go straight to that person and say, right, what do you think about this new idea we've got for a wellness plan? They will give you the 50 reasons why it's never going to work and it's rubbish. And then all of a sudden we have this awkward silence where everybody says, I don't know where to go now. What do we do with the meeting? And that can come across as very negative, until we all can joke about it and talk about it. And we say, we know that's what this person is thinking, because they're figuring out how to improve it and make it vastly better. So let's come to you later. Let's start with Lauren over here, who is really good and really interested at why we're going to do it, who's going to do it, and all the other things. And for us, that was a huge game changer from reviews, meetings, you know, our leadership meetings. We can often now start with that, and we can very quickly pick up someone who's feeling very low, who wouldn't normally talk to us about it because that's their sort of personality, as we said before, in that they like to take on jobs and just get lots of jobs done without complaining. But because we know that, we can institute a system of finding out about it. And if you say to me, hey, actually, I'm only a 2 out of 10 today, we can say, that's good. Is that something we want to talk about? Is it a work thing? Or you might say, it's a home thing. Can we just move on? But just so you know, I'm a 2 out of 10. So I can think, well, that extra big job I was going to give you, let's push that on till next week. So for me, that was one of the, it seems very big and weird and almost a little bit scary until we actually get into it. But we use it every day. And it's honestly been one of the biggest changes in how we manage our practice.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting when you're saying about like that everybody's getting assessed, because one thing, you know, we talk a lot about like know your employees, but equally actually as managers, you need to know yourself as well and know how you react. And we actually at Citation, we've done some psychological profiling as well. It's quite really interesting reading, you know, when I was reading my report about me, I was like, oh gosh, I sort of, some things that you're not necessarily are going to accept. Oh, no, not accept. Sorry, that's not the right word. But it's enlightening, isn't it?
It is. And it helps you. Again, we use it because we sort of say, actually, some of the things that I will do that my team get really annoyed with, they can be thinking, oh, Stephen's a pain in the bottom because he just doesn't do it. And vice versa. But when we can say, actually, I'm not very good at finishing these tasks. I'm very good at coming up with 1,000 ideas and getting them to 90%, but I'm not very good at doing the last 10 or 20%. It means, A, they understand that's not me just being annoying. It's not an excuse, but it's how my brain works best. But it also means we can team up with somebody else in the practice who we say, actually, you are not so good at coming up with 1,000 ideas, but you're amazing at me passing over to you and the job gets done where I never could. So I agree. I think it's so powerful to know your strengths, your weaknesses, how you work. It's brilliant for relationships. It should be kind of standard issue for all marriages, I think, to tell you how to deal with someone else's good points, bad points, and why you butt heads. And I suppose you spend almost more time at work than you do at home. So it kind of is like a marriage at will. But it's incredible. And as you say, we do, I know some businesses only do the leadership team, which we started with because obviously we wanted their buy-in and it not to be too scary. And some people envisage it being sort of metal sensors on the head where you're sort of probing them. But once we sort of went to everybody in the whole team, again, it was really useful to know in a unit of nurses or vets, some people are really good at this, some people are really good at that. And it's okay for me to lean on you, Emma, because you're good at that and I'm less good. And it also means that when you're not so good at that, you and I both know it's okay for you to lean on me and give me those jobs to make that the whole team work better.
And your passion for that, it really comes through in how you're describing and talking about it now. So Chris, anything to add to that?
No, I love Stephen's idea of bringing good HR practice into your home relationships. I'm sure I'd be well past my final written warning on loading the dishwasher by an end if we were documenting everything that I did badly as a partner. But no, I like Stephen, I'm a massive fan of these behavioral profiling tools, if they're used correctly, so you're not putting people into boxes, that actually it's a color profile. It's not, I am that, therefore I'm not this. And if it helps you primarily understand yourself and other people and how you can then interact together. And the only other thing that I would add, just in terms of rotas and so on, is make sure people take breaks. Now, I know we work in a very different environment to when I first started as a manager. I worked in a small bookshop, but my first job in the morning as a manager was to walk around everybody and go, right, what time are you having your lunch? Okay, let's plan your coffee break either side of that, and then make sure everybody went on time. So having a little bit of that sort of discipline, because before we know it, somebody's worked all day, not taking a break, and we didn't know because we work in such a disparate environment at times.
Excellent, great advice. So Emma, staying on the topic of practical tools, I guess a big part of this is making sure managers feel equipped. So how important, Emma, is it to give line managers proper HR training and the tools they need to feel comfortable having those difficult conversations and enabling them to support the staff early and use things like adjustments or policies effectively?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important. I mean, one of the reasons for that is that I think it can take a lot of courage for an employee to say that they're struggling. You know, obviously it depends on the culture, but it might feel that they've really sort of put themselves out there by opening up. So, you know, it would be really horrendous for them to do that and then to feel like no action's being taken, and that's going to, you know, sort of increase their feelings of negativity. So yeah, it's really important to action it. I suppose to get them into the door, you know, you want to have that open door policy, you know, just saying, look, any issues, come and chat to us, you know, having that sort of culture where people just check in, as we've touched on. So you want to be training your managers how to do that. You want to have, you know, a sort of good policies in place. I mean, hopefully you wouldn't get to the stage of sort of grievances and things, but, you know, it's good to have that sort of, that kind of more formal policy there so that it, you know, employees know that there is that culture within the practice to want to know when things aren't going right. There's things like employee assistance programs, which are like confidential counselling programs that can be offered to staff. You know, obviously that wouldn't be something that would be fed back to the employer at all, but it's there as a, you know, a coping mechanism for people. I know Stephen talked before about sort of controlling workloads and things, and, you know, thinking about how you can. And obviously, you know, Chris has talked about breaks. So it is that sort of trying to empower people as well that can sort of reduce stress. I was going to mention as well about wellness action plans, which, again, we've really touched on these, but these are actual sort of formal documented plans that a manager would sit down and discuss with an employee where, you know, they say like what they find stressful, what they think are the signs that they are struggling to cope, what they would want their manager to do if they see those signs, what they would not want them to do, you know. So sometimes people don't want to be checked on all the time, but, you know, they know that they've got sort of certain mental health issues going on, for example, you know, they want only sort of, you know, not being spoken to all the time, you know, but that would be the kind of thing that you can agree with them. And then thinking about, I suppose, things like, you know, adjustments. So, you know, obviously for disabled employees, then there is a, you know, there is a legal duty to make reasonable adjustments. But equally for any employee, you know, you want to be thinking about what can you reasonably adjust for them that would help put in those support mechanisms.
Emma, I think that's really, you're talking about almost, and we had a leadership strategy day a couple of weeks ago with the leadership team, and one of the things that came up was a slight individualizing for the team, and you sort of chimpy automatic responses, oh, that's too hard, I'm too busy, and the practice is too busy to individualize 25 different people. But when we sort of explored it further, it was sometimes as simple as just if you're a nurse doing a certain shift today, to say, you know, what things would cause a problem today. Now, often that might be being shipped from this to a consultation to this to that, because that's what work needs. So sometimes just knowing that, you know, you put your boss head on, this needs this, 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 is to go, actually, this is incredibly stressful for this person. Sometimes that same thing isn't stressful to somebody else. So sometimes we, by both knowing the team, but also asking, again, what's important to you today? Well, sometimes, again, one of the things we found was the nurses on inpatient shifts, for them was often really important that they not get moved around to different shifts because they felt like they were then doing a bad job at the end of the day because they weren't looking after their patients. And it was very easy to, when you wanted to grab someone, just grab the nearest person. But when the head nurse, for example, was able to realize that, was then able to sort of engage our brain and say, okay, let's add just one very small layer that was pretty easy to do, to say, in an urgent situation, let's grab you rather than you. And individualizing it a bit, again, with questions like, when things go terribly busy and someone needs to stay, we've often just assume everyone just stay. Nobody walks out of the building, instead of just asking, saying, Emma, is it okay? Do you need to phone anyone at home? Can you stay for an hour? Nearly always the answer is yes. But I think just that empowerment of giving you the power to go, you can say no, and you've not lost your job if you can't say no. We're all in this because we love animals. But that also makes a huge difference, I think, just saying, is it okay? Can you stay for an hour? Rather than just, oh, you're here for an hour, I expected you to be, and you haven't had a time for a wee or to phone your spouse or pick up the kids or anything.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Great. Look, that's been fabulous. I've got one final question to ask each of you in turn. So, and that question is, what role do membership organisations or external support providers play in helping practices reduce burnout? And I'm going to go Stephen, I'm then going to go to Chris, and I'm going to finish off with Emma. So Stephen first, please. What role does SPIVs play in reducing burnout?
I think it's really hard if you've been a profession like a nurse or a vet. You've trained for years and years to do that, and you're probably very good at it. I think a lot of the way that we have learned how to become leaders and managers is just by default and failing and doing the wrong way 10 times over before the 11th way is correct. And although there are benefits to that, I think now a lot of the external support providers, whether that's Citation or SPIVs, allow you to talk to someone who's already done it and has the expertise and say, I've already made those mistakes. Feel free to make them again, or skip forward 5 years and here's my advice and here's how it did and didn't work out. So I think that's the beauty of any external support provider, someone you have a good relationship, you know their interests align with yours, and that they can then just give you that knowledge that you have in one field and they have in another field.
Superb. Thank you. And Chris, same question for VMG.
Leaders obviously need support too, and in fact probably more so than many people realize. It can be a very lonely job, as a lot of people realize when they first get promoted into a management position. Suddenly their good friends treat them very differently. So what VMG does, we exist to kind of support the capability, confidence, connection for leaders across every role, and we provide leadership and management development through our courses. People can get qualifications or just through CPD, but equally importantly, through things such as our share space and tutorials, if you're on our courses, a chance for peer learning and shared experience, and to help people kind of step back from the firefighting and make better long-term decisions and feel less isolated in their roles.
Excellent. Thank you. And Emma, finally, external providers.
Yeah, so, certainly at Citation, we provide, you know, the sort of the basic foundation of the policies and the procedures and the risk assessments to have in place that really sort of, you know, try and manage a sort of a safe working environment where people can thrive and have great well-being. But also, you know, as we've talked about, people are individuals. And what we particularly do is talk to our vet practice clients about individual situations and individual employees. And we would help them adjust how they are reacting to that and, you know, how they deal with that situation in accordance with how that employee is. So, you know, I think it's really important to remember there's no one size fits all solution every time, you know, for all employees. You really do have to tailor it to the situation. So I think that's where that specific advice comes in.
Superb. Thank you. Gosh, we've covered a lot of ground. So let me try to bring it all together and close the loop. So well-being isn't always a guarantee, especially in the vet sector. But with strong HR and health and safety foundations, you can encourage a culture where people feel supported. A huge thank you to Emma McGrath from Citation, to Chris White from the Veterinary Management Group, and Stephen Goodear from SPIBS for such an honest and constructive discussion. And to our listeners, thanks for listening. If you need more hands-on support, head to citation.co.uk and discover how we can support your practice. We'll see you next time.